Verse 1 of chapter 4 of the book of Genesis. Now Adam knew Eve, his wife. That doesn't mean that they were introduced to one another. That means that they had marital relations with one another, because birthed on this knowing, she, being Eve, conceived and bore Cain. And then she declared that I have acquired a man from the Lord, and so she bore again, this time his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. And in the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Lord. Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat. And the Lord respected Abel and his offering, but he did not respect Cain and his offering. Therefore Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. Now, before we unpack, I think, the depth of what's taking place and this very familiar story, I think it's important and probably helpful for us to maybe even get just a bit of a running start into these verses. Because as we approach these verses, there's a few things that seem, well, interesting. Adam and Eve, we know their story, we know their history. Adam was the crescendo of creation. God spoke everything into existence, but he made the creation of Adam, man, a very personal exercise. God spoke everything else, and it was there, but with man, God formed him, we're told, from the dust of the earth, and then God breathed life into man. Man was created, therefore, in the image and the likeness of God. Was mind, body, and soul. But as God looked upon creation, one thing dawned on the Father, that it was not good for man to be alone. So God revealed this need to Adam by having him name the animals, and it's in that process that Adam began to realize that there was none compatible to him. So God caused a deep sleep to fall on Adam, and then took of the rib of Adam and formed Eve. And gave Eve to Adam to be his wife. And they were given the dominion over all of creation. It's amazing to consider that all of creation, everything dealing with the natural universe, exists for one sole reason. That is for the enjoyment of man. If you look up in the dark sky to see the diamonds of the stars sprinkled out across the black velvet, do you realize that that beautiful sight God created with the galaxies, he created for you and I, for our enjoyment. A beautiful sunset has been created for our enjoyment. The beach has been created for our enjoyment. And oh, do we enjoy the beach. A wonderful mountaintop for our enjoyment. Beautiful birds and flowers, gardens for our enjoyment. Creation was for man. For his enjoyment. And his job was to have dominion over that which he was to enjoy. Now, specifically, God gave Adam and Eve a job. Their job was to take care of this incredible garden, the Garden of Eden, that they lived in, that they resided amongst. And so they were to take care of the garden. They could eat and enjoy of all of the fruit except for one tree, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, they were to stay away from. They could eat of the tree of life and live forever. And we're told that God would come in the cool of the day and would walk with Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve were perfect. They lived in a world without sin, a world without strife, a world without pain, a world without suffering, a world that we all imagine. And politicians claim that if you vote for them, they could provide. Adam and Eve had at their fingertips. Life was grand. And it was glorious. They had a perfect relationship with one another. They had a perfect relationship with the Father. There was no inhibition, nothing that separated them from their Creator. And yet one day, as we know the story, man made a horrible choice to rebel. God had one rule: don't eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But Adam and Eve were enticed by Lucifer. They took of the fruit, they ate of it. And we see immediate consequences. Immediate consequences. Now, the ultimate consequence is that they would be kicked out of the garden, that they would be separated from God, that they would not be allowed access to the tree of life. God had promised that on the day that you eat of this, you'll surely die. They would die spiritually. They would die in regards to the relationship that they would have with God. It would never be the same. Their relationship with one another would change as well. Right there from the beginning, God comes down, and what do we see? We see strife in the midst of Adam and Eve. They're blaming each other. They're playing the blame game, and we've been doing that ever since. There was hostility between Adam and Eve. Eve would experience pain in labor, and Adam would experience pain just always in his labor. Now, what's fascinating is that the immediate consequence, the immediate result, the moment they ate of this fruit, the Bible tells us that one of the initial consequences of sin was that they understood, they became aware of their nakedness. Now, before they were naked, but they didn't have any fear. They didn't have any inhibitions. There was no self-consciousness. There was no worry of what the other person would think. They just enjoyed each other. But when sin entered, there was a spiritual result that resulted, that manifested into a physical consequence or physical manifestation. A spiritual consequence, a spiritual choice, a spiritual decision that immediately left itself with like a physical result, a manifestation, something tangible. They understood that they were naked. And so what did they decide they needed to do? They needed to cover themselves. Isn't it interesting that of all of quote unquote the animal species, it's only humanity that senses the need to cover oneself? That it's only humanity that senses a need to actually wear clothing? You don't see this in birds or animals. Our dog Kaya, we have a full-blooded blue Shar Pei. She's got skin upon skin upon skin, fur upon fur upon fur. She does not need clothing. And for whatever reason, a few years ago, my wife got this incredible idea that we were gonna put like kind of a Christmas sweater on my dog. I had to wrestle with my dog to get this sweater on. And we're in the kitchen. And we get this sweater on Kaya, and she looked at me like, you have got to be kidding me. I hate you right now, is really what her eyes were communicating. And she froze. She did not move. She did not budge. I went into the living room. We ended up going upstairs. An hour later, I'm like, Jess, where's our dog? We're looking around. We're like, so I go back downstairs. She has not moved from the spot that she was left in the kitchen. She's still just looking at me like, I'm waiting. Do you not realize this is ridiculous? And I did. So we took it off, never again, and she just took running off. Like, dogs don't need, we put clothing on dogs because we laugh and it brings us enjoyment. They don't need it. Mankind is the only quote-unquote animal species that senses a need for clothing. And why is this? You know, the evolutionist provides no reason. No reason at all. And if it was natural selection, if it was survival of the fittest, then years and years and years ago, those of us that couldn't grow much hair would have died out. Those of us that could have grown a lot of hair would have progressed on, would have been attracted to women that could subsequently grow a lot of hair, and they would have produced babies that produce lots of hair, and we would not be the way we are now. If you had a lot of back hair, that would have been a benefit if it were just evolution. But it's not. So why did man sense this need to clothe himself? The need to clothe himself came from an awareness that they were dirty, that they were exposed, that something was wrong. Now, I can prove this reaction. Once again, a spiritual decision manifesting itself in a physical sense. Have you ever done something that you knew was wrong? I mean, that was not a debate. It wasn't a gray area. You knew that the decision you were making, that the choice that you had made was sinful, that it was wrong, that it went against the commands and the will of God. And upon doing it, the moment after you did it, did you feel grand or did you feel glorious? Or in the moment that you exited that behavior, were you overcome with a sense of self-awareness and dirtiness? It's true. It's evident. The Axe body wash commercials. Do you know they've actually marketed their soap to this reality? It's interesting. Because if you see the Axe body wash commercials, what's their whole campaign? Their campaign will show some 20-year-old deadbeat degenerate who goes out, lives up the day, finds himself like passed out drunk in Mexico, makes his way back, ends up dumped on his front yard, and in the process has all these snapshots of like multiple sexual partners partying and drinking and living it up, and he's there on his front yard, he wakes up, and then boom, Axe body wash, making a dirty boy clean. That's the whole marketing campaign. Making a dirty boy clean, because they're appealing, interestingly enough, not to being physically dirty, but some deeper sense. You see, Adam and Eve sense this immediately. And so, and this awareness that I'm sinful, that I'm unclean, that something is wrong with me based upon this sinful decision that I made, what was their remedy? Well, the Bible tells us that their remedy was that they sewed together fig leaves for covering. Now, this is a really bad idea in really two ways. First, have you ever seen a fig leaf? Probably not. A fig leaf is a really prickly leaf. It's got like really small, kind of sharp, serrated edges on the ends. Can you imagine sewing together fig leaves and then wearing these coverings? How itchy and uncomfortable and just totally awkward that would be. Like, not a really smart idea. I can think of a lot of other leaves that would probably maybe have been a more comfortable attire if you're trying to make a covering. The second problem is, imagine the durability of leaves. You know, we don't make clothing out of leaves. I don't know anyone that actually makes clothing out of leaves. You have a problem in your home, you call a plumber. Can you imagine how awkward it would be if your plumber showed up wearing leave jeans? Not Levi, but leave. If you think that you just naturally got a half moon in your kitchen, if it was only leaves covering that guy's behind, it would be a full moon in your kitchen. Not very durable. I mean, what, you get maybe an hour of use out of leave jeans? You sit down, they crumble up. I mean, what are you going to do? I mean, not a good idea, not very adequate, not very comfortable. It's not going to work. And so, we're told that God, after this whole exchange, and you can read all of this, just three chapters and you're caught up. God comes and we're told that he sees their covering, these fig leaves, and then what does he do? He provides them a better covering and the sense of lambskins. Now, though we're not told how God provided them these skins, you know, skins don't grow on trees. I didn't know if you knew that. I know that's some grand revelation to some of you. You can't go to a forest and go out an orchard and pick, like, I'm going to grab a barrel of apples and a barrel of fleece sweaters. Like, that's not how it works. And there's not an Old Navy for God to go to get some fleece sweatshirts for Adam and Eve. So how did God end up with these coverings? Well, most biblical scholars agree that just by deduction, God slaughtered two animals to provide covering. Adam and Eve stepped out to provide their own covering and these fig leaves to deal with this sin that they were experiencing. Proved to be a bad idea, it wouldn't work, and it was inadequate. So God set a precedent by establishing a more adequate covering in the sense of lambskin. Now, most people believe that this is the precedent by which Adam continued through the amount of time that exists between chapters 3 and 4. We don't know. We do not know how much time transpires between the close of Genesis 3 and the openings of Genesis chapter 4. We don't know. Obviously, enough time transpires so that there can be two children. Could there have been more children? Possibly. We just don't know. You had Cain and you had Abel. And it seems as though that whether it was a yearly exercise or a frequent exercise, that Adam would continuously go and taught this to his children, would go and make sacrifices to the Lord. Continuing with this sin nature, understanding that he's ruined this relationship with God by his own choices, that God had maybe made this offering, had maybe established this precedent and giving them covering, saying these fig leaves, this stuff doesn't work, here's some adequate covering, I'm slaughtering these animals. And so Adam may be concluding that this was a favorable exercise to God and trying to go and find favor with God, Adam would go and make these sacrifices, these offerings. We don't know how often, we don't know how frequent, other than the fact that at some point in the process of time, Adam comes to his two sons and he says, listen, guys, we're going to go at such and such a day, we're going to go make offerings. We're going to make offerings. So go ahead and prepare yourself for that particular day. Now, we're told that Cain was a farmer. And let's be honest, that's a great job for the first family because they're all vegetarians. And so Cain serves a very functional role in regards to the family. He grows food that they can eat. His brother also provides a good service. He's a shepherd. So he's taking care of sheep and he's overseeing herds and flocks. Now, they didn't eat these animals, but that's how they got their clothing. And in addition to that, more than likely, how they got their milk, how they got also some of their sustenance. And so both of the boys are contributing to the family. They're both working. They're both part of this first family. You have Cain the farmer and you have Abel the shepherd. And so they decide that they're going to make sacrifices to God based upon, well, the things that they're good at, the things that are accustomed to them. And to make a long story short, Cain comes and offers this sacrifice of the fruit of his flock, the fruit of the ground, the fruit of his harvest. That would be it. And then you have Abel that's out there and he's taking one of, his flock and he's making this offering. And then it's interesting because we're told, as we read, that God rejected Cain and his offering. And please note that. Please note that. Back to verse 4. Abel brought of the firstborn. The Lord respected Abel, underline that, but he did not respect Cain, underline that. Cain makes this offering and it's rejected. Abel makes this offering, it's accepted. Now, most Bible teachers that you'll listen to covering this particular passage of Scripture will use the precedent established by God of a blood offering as the reasoning that Abel's was accepted and Cain was rejected. But there are two fundamental problems with that thought. One, if you get to the law, which does happen quite a few years later, you find that offerings to God did not have to be blood. Now, yes, there were blood offerings that could be made. A lamb, you could even offer birds if you were poor. I mean, you could offer blood offerings the day of Passover, but we also see, according to the law of Moses, quite a lot of other types of offerings, grain offerings and fruit offerings and spice offerings that not only were made to God, but that God was delighted in, that God sanctioned, God approved, that God enjoyed. And so if it's solely the nature of the actual sacrifice being made here, that Abel's was blood and that Cain's was this fruit cocktail, there's a problem just simply in the sense of later in Scripture. It's not a consistent precedent. The second problem that I have with that particular outlook is that we're not told that it was the sacrifice itself that God accepted or rejected, as I just mentioned, as you just underlined. The offering itself was secondary to the person making the offering. We're told that God respected Abel, but God rejected Cain. You see, I'm of the opinion that the issue here with God was not the actual sacrifice being made, but was rather the attitude behind the offering. And think about this for a moment. Embellish me. Think about Cain. Father Adam says, Cain, we're going to go make an offering. You got a couple months, get yourself ready. And Cain's excited about the opportunity. I mean, going and making offerings before God, this is what God wants. This is how I get favor with God. This is how I'm honoring to God. This is how God is now pleased with me, making this offering, this whole thing. And so he's serious about it. I think with all sincerity, based upon his reaction by being rejected, that Cain approached this whole thing with a serious tone, that he was not approaching this offering haphazardly or in this relaxed manner. I think Cain was really serious about the exercise of making an offering before God. And I can see he gets the word, he goes out and he looks into the field and he's looking for a plot of earth that he's going to set aside just for God. I mean, it needs the right conditions, the right amount of sunshine, the right amount of shade. I mean, this is going to be for God's crop. And so Cain sets aside this plot of earth, this plot of soil that he's going to set just for God. This is going to be God's crop. And then he begins to clear off the land, which is backbreaking work. The thorns and the thistles and the shrubs and the vegetation that might have already existed, he's clearing off the land. Knocking down trees, digging up roots. He's getting now the soil tilled up. He's maybe even going over to his brother Abel. He's saying, Abel, I need to borrow some manure. So let me go out into the fields. Let me get some manure in my wheelbarrow. He brings it over and he mixes it in. And Abel's like, well, why would you want manure? And Cain's like, well, I don't know. Later on, you'll find out it's fertilizer, but it just seems to help the plants grow. So he's mixing it in with the soil. Anyone that's ever done a garden or planted flowers knows that the first step of the process is prepping the earth. I mean, it doesn't matter how great the plant is. If you don't prep the earth, if you don't till it up, get the soil loose, if you're not watering, if you're not making sure you're adding in fertilizer or some Miracle-Gro, if you're not prepping the earth appropriately, your flowers or your, they don't have a chance. And so Cain, he's working the earth, he's tilling it up, he's adding fertilizer, and then when he begins to get it just right, he's like, okay, now it's time to plant. But it's not like he goes to Home Depot. He goes out into the other orchards, the other fields, and he's looking through the plants and he's picking out seeds. Seeds from a good crop. Something that he can really work with. Only the best for God. I mean, that's his whole mindset. So he's going out and he's picking some seeds from this batch of plants and some seeds from this fruit and this vegetables. And he's going and he's getting just the best of the best of the best of what he has that he's going to plant in this plot of earth he's given to God. And so he plants. And then day after day after day, what is Cain doing? After he's worked the fields with his free time, he's going over and he's making sure that no wild animals have made its way in. He's making sure that there's no weeds. He's making sure things are watered. He's making sure that things are being pruned back. For days and weeks, more than likely months, Cain works tirelessly on this crop. And the day comes that they're going to go make the offering, and he gets his wicker basket. He goes, and he's just now picking the best of the best of the best to give to God. Because really, God deserves only the best that Cain has to offer. He's not going to give God seconds. And so he's making sure that it's perfect. The basket that Cain puts together, and I can imagine all the colors and all the smells and the arrangement. You could have marketed these and sold them on Valentine's Day. That's how glorious this basket was probably. And he goes to the altar, and he takes literally the fruit of his labor, and he sets it on the altar. And it's this that he's offering to God so that God would be pleased and honored and accepting towards Cain. I've done all of this for you, God. I've worked hard through my blood, sweat, and tears. This is the best that I have to offer. This is his whole attitude. Which is why when God rejects the best that Cain has to offer, it kind of ticks him off. Like his countenance falls. He gets angry. He'll ultimately kill his brother. He gets rejected, doesn't he? And no one likes rejection. But he's now been rejected by God, and it's embarrassing. And if the best of the best of the best, if the fruit of his labor, the best he has to offer, isn't good enough for God, then what's he gonna do? What can he do? He's totally up the creek without a paddle. If God's going to reject that crop, because there's nobody in the world that can do that but me. And he's bummed out. Now, flip to Abel for a moment, because Abel's entire experience is different than his brother. Totally different experience. Cain's working hard. It's the fruit of his labor. But Abel, this is not a real extensive or painstaking process. He gets word, there's a sacrifice coming. I can see he goes out into the flocks. He's walking around. He's looking at like the best little lamb. He's like, oh, look at how cute and cuddly. And he inspects the lamb, and he's like, seems to be pretty spotless to me. The best of the litter. And so because he wants to ensure that upon offering day, this little lamb remains spotless and pure, he, I'm sure, keeps it with him. For days and for weeks and for months, this little lamb, in my estimation and how I kind of imagine it, it lives with Abel. It probably ends up becoming his pet. He feeds this lamb. He takes the lamb out to use the restroom. He's protecting the lamb. On the cold night, he's cuddling with the lamb, not just to keep the lamb warm, but for the lamb to keep him warm. Ultimately, this lamb becomes part of the family, like most of our pets do. He cherishes, he probably even names this lamb. Something like Geppetto, I don't know. His pet lamb, Geppetto. And he loves this little lamb, takes care of trimming its nails and grooming it. And he loves it. He identifies himself with it. This is his pet. I had Mickey Hawkins' house sit a couple weeks ago. And I told him before we left, I said, Mickey, you have all of my earthly possessions right here. You're going to watch them for a week. All of my earthly possessions, everything I own, is here in my house. If there's a fire, I don't care about any of it. But if you have to run through flame and smoke to save my dog, you run through flame and smoke to save my dog. Because if my dog dies, I'm going to kill you. Everything else can burn. Burn to the ground. But you got to save my dog. And I was serious. Because I can't replace my dog. Yeah, maybe with a different one, but not her. And I love my dog. I care about my dog. It would bum me out if my dog died, fire. The whole time it's thinking, Zach, where are you? Why aren't you safe? It would just bum me out. But imagine for a moment, and we have pets, we connect with animals. It's a weird thing. But imagine on offering day, Abel looks at this stack of rocks, his Weber grill, you know, flames jumping. And as he begins to walk towards the altar, he's got his little lamb in his arms. This lamb loves him. And I can see this lamb just looking up at Abel, just with those big old innocent eyes. This little lamb trusts Abel completely, loves Abel implicitly. I can even see the little lamb, you know, resting its head right up against Abel's chest, maybe even leaning up and kind of licking his cheek. We look down, and Abel begins to cry because he knows what's coming. Abel knows what's about to happen. The little lamb, no idea. Just going for a walk, for all the lamb knows. And as they get closer, and this lamb is, you know, cute and cuddly, Abel reaches behind and he pulls out a knife. And without the lamb knowing it, Abel runs this knife across this lamb's neck. And the blood begins to pour. And Abel's looking down at this lamb. And now it's not just tears. I mean, he's weeping. Imagine you having to, like, to offer your dog as a sacrifice. When my childhood dog died, it was brutal. I spent 12 years of my life with that dog. It's brutal. And they just put her down with an injection. They were able to do it in the home. And man, it's not just one of those weeping. It's one of those cries where it's like you just don't even know where the tears stop and the snot begins. It's one of those kind of tear jerkers. And Abel's crying, and that lamb is looking up with these eyes of horror. I trusted you. What did I do? Was I not good enough? Did you not love me? I trusted you. And as the life begins to exit the eyes, I can see it even cry out. Because, you know, the blood's running down into the vocal cords. Maybe I'm just a little graphic and that's disturbing. But you'll never hock up phlegm ever again and not think of a lamb. Dying. But you're able now. And you've got blood. I mean, pouring down your shirt. You can never wear that shirt again. I mean, that shirt's ruined. And blood covering your hands, up on your face. You're a bloody mess. And you take this lamb and you set it on this sacrifice. You set it on the altar. It's your sacrifice. And you step back. You're doing this for favor, for God to honor it. To gain God's favor, to gain God's acceptance, you're making this offer. And I'm sure you're standing there like, why? Why is this necessary? Why is this how it has to be? There's no pride. You didn't do anything. All you did, you identified with this animal who died so you could have God's favor. That's all you did. And you're bummed out. And you're so aware of what it takes for you to have God's favor, that innocent lamb that did nothing wrong had to bleed and die for you. And Abel's there, a broken man, a humbled man, a contrite man, because God looks at this sacrifice and he looks at Abel's attitude and everything going on within him, and he looks favorably. Cain, your pride, the best you have to offer, you coming to the altar saying, God, I'm good enough. I've worked hard enough. This is what I'm offering. This is what I've done for you, God. And then you have Abel who's like, I've done nothing. It's that sacrifice that did something, that died. I stand here empty. Can't do anything. And God accepts Abel and he rejects Cain. And do you realize that subsequently that summarizes religion? There are only two religions in this world. There is the way of Cain and there is the way of Abel. The sacrifice of Cain is mankind working to earn God's favor. Mankind working to earn God's approval. Mankind obeying commandments and obeying paths and obeying pillars of faith. It's man working his way to God. So when I die and I stand before God, I can say, I've earned it. I've worked hard for it. I've been good, God. Whether it's Judaism, whether it's Catholicism, whether it's Islam, whether it's Buddhism or Hinduism, all world religions, from Mormonism to Jehovah's Witness to wacky Scientologists, it's all based in the way of Cain that based this whole mechanism on how I can come to God and earn his favor. But God did not look favorably upon it when it was Cain, and he has never looked favorably upon it, because the truth is we can never be good enough. We can never be good enough. But the second religion is the way of Abel. It's exemplified in Christianity. How do I earn God's favor? I can't. What do I do to earn God's salvation? Nothing. There's nothing I can do. There's nothing in and of myself. I can never be good enough. But it's not about being good enough. It's about a sacrifice that was made. It's about Jesus and what he did on the cross, the pure and spotless Lamb of God, who did not die for his sin, but died for the sin of the world. And if we, as Abel, approach God with a sacrifice in between us and God's holiness, so that when God sees me, it's through this bloody altar that atones for my sin. And when I approach God through an offering, the offering made by Jesus, God looks favorably. We're told that we're saved by grace through faith. It is not of ourselves. It is a gift from God. Not one that can be earned, but one that is solely bestowed. There are many of us that are trying to earn the favor of God, when instead we should approach the cross and recognize that if we believe in faith, that favor is bestowed, that it's given. I can't earn it. I don't deserve it. But it's given by an offering. And yes, it's a bloody one. We talk about grace being free. And it's a glorious reality that grace is free to those who receive grace. But please never confuse the reality that grace is not cheap. It might be free to us, but it's not cheap. Grace is very expensive. It's free for me, the one receiving, but the one giving, interestingly enough, it cost everything. God's grace can only be given through God's sacrifice, and that of his son Jesus. That of his son Jesus. Now, before you think that God's interactions with Cain, that Cain somehow didn't understand this, and that he ends up being kind of the negative precedent we've all lived after. If you go back, as mentioned, to Adam and Eve and the Father, I think the precedent was established then. Not in necessarily the fact that it was a blood offering, but I think the attitude. Because Adam and Eve, yes, they sewed together these fig leaves that proved to be inadequate. They tried in their best attempt to deal with their sin, and it didn't work. And so God provided covering for their sin that was adequate. And I think God was not just establishing, yes, this precedent for blood being spilt for our ultimate atonement, but I think God also was establishing an attitude. An attitude that I think Cain directly rebelled against. That he thought, well, yeah, my parents blew it, but I think I'm good enough. You see, God taught Adam and Eve that you'll never be able to provide an adequate covering. You'll never be able to set up a mechanism by which you'll achieve perfection. It can only be given by me, the Father. Interestingly, if you'll turn in your Bible to Matthew 21, and this is where we'll close. But there is a very weird story, and traditionally known as the Passion Week, following the triumphal entry on Palm Sunday. That week ultimately concludes with the resurrection of Jesus on Easter Sunday, Resurrection Day. There's a horrible tragedy in the midst of it all with Jesus' crucifixion. Before Jesus spends time, Passover, sometime Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday, Jesus is making his way back and forth from Bethany to Jerusalem. Bethany, it was a suburb. Jesus loved the burbs. We're told in verse 18 of chapter 21, a very odd exchange. That in the morning, as Jesus was returning to the city, that being Jerusalem, he was hungry. And seeing a fig tree by the road, Jesus came to it, and he found nothing on it but leaves. And he said, "Let no fruit grow on you ever again." And immediately the fig tree withered away. So Jesus is walking to Jerusalem. He's hungry. He's looking for a Dunkin'. He can't find a Dunkin'. He sees a fig tree, thinking, oh, a fig tree. I'll grab a fig. I'll eat it on the way. There's no figs. So Jesus says, "Curse you." And it withers and dies. Bizarre, kind of like this weird, impulsive decision by Jesus to like curse this poor, what did the poor tree do? As a matter of fact, this is so bizarre that when the disciples saw it, they kind of marveled. They kind of are scratching their head, and they said, "How did the fig tree wither away so soon?" Now note, they did not ask Jesus why he cursed the fig tree. They kind of want to know, like, that's kind of a cool trick. Hey, how cool would that be to walk around like cursed trees, and like they just wither up? It's nice to add to the repertoire of like healing people of blindness and resurrecting the dead, cursing trees. How can we do that? That's what they're asking. And so Jesus answers their question about how he did it. He said, "Assuredly, I say to you, if you have faith and you don't doubt, you will not only do what was done to the fig tree, but you will also say to this mountain, be removed, be cast into the sea, it'll be done. And whatever things you ask in prayer, believing, you will receive." He talks about faith, our power based in faith. And we're not going to discuss that. Jesus addresses how, the mechanism of cursing the fig tree. He never addresses why, which leads us to one of the great mysteries, it's perplexing. And you can read scholar after scholar after scholar, commentary after commentary after commentary about why did he curse the fig tree? And you will get a bunch of various answers. I mean, that get very detailed, down to like, well, the fig represented Israel and Israel was about to crucify. I mean, you'll get into some crazy stuff. I have a theory. Who was walking in the cool of the evening with Adam and Eve in the garden? We're told very specifically walking. And it's not as though that Jesus became Jesus when he became Jesus. The Trinity's always existed in three persons. It's eternal. The physical manifestation of God, walking with Adam and Eve in the cool of the evening. It wasn't this glowing orb that kind of like floated its way. And so they followed this incredible like trail of light, and that's what they interacted with. No. I believe fully that who do they walk with in the cool of the evening? They walked with God. They walked with Jesus. And who was it that saw these fig leaves and said, "Pfft"? And who was it that made the first offering? Who was it that shed blood to make a covering for these two morons? The same person that would ultimately be a covering for all of us morons. I think it was Jesus. And for me, this makes a lot of sense why Jesus would take a moment as he's walking to be the sacrifice for the sins of the world. He looks over at fig leaves. And I think he thought back to that moment when he saw Adam and Eve come out behind the bush with these fig leaf coverings. And Jesus looked over on his way to Golgotha and he said, "You figs, you were not a good offering then. You're not a good offering today. You'll never be an adequate offering. You will never be an adequate covering." And he cursed it. And then he went and died and paid for the sins of the world and was the adequate covering, the adequate sacrifice. This morning, first, if you've been working hard to earn God's approval, stop. That's your pastor telling you, stop. You already have it. You can't earn more of it. You can't run out of it. It's God's favor. It's been given. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't live a godly life, but it's in response to grace. It's not to earn it. It's not to earn it. But then if there's some of you that are trying to work your way to God, and you're thinking that when you die and you stand before the Father in heaven, that it'll be your goodness. I'm a good person. Cain thought he was a good person. But please understand that God will reject that, because you're actually not a good person. You're not good enough. And we have to approach the Lord through a sacrifice.